Sucheca Talk, Artist in Residences in the Amazon Rainforest, Peru. Hi, I'm Trina Brommer, and with us here today is Ellen Glarum Haudlum. Ellen came to Sucheca to learn about the natural pigments and originally came for 2 months, but then returned and stayed with us a further month. Hi, Ellen, you've had quite a journey with us at Sucheca. Can you please fill us in and talk about your full Sucheca experience? Thank you.
Yes. So the first time I came to Sucheca, it was in 2015, November, December. And I had just finished my bachelor degree in art the same year. And coming to the Amazon jungle and the Sucheca Art Center was like this big turning point for both my life and my artistic expression. I had been, in a way, I knew I had been longing to go to the Amazon ever since I was a child, in a way, because I had always been so interested in plants, and I knew that in the Amazon it was the most diverse forests in the world, and be able to be outside in nature while painting. And then I was thinking that, wouldn't it be amazing if I could paint in nature with nature itself? So I started thinking about, is there a way that I can learn how to paint using colors from nature? And that's how I found out about the Sucheca. And yeah, so... But I couldn't even imagine how, like, what was going, or how that experience was going to be before I came there. Because the experience of coming to Sucheca was like, it met so many of my longings, because it felt like everything was magical when I got there. And the experience of meeting the other artists that were there, and meeting Trina, who is, yeah, you are like a very, very special person and very inspiring. And you and the other artists, like, really opened my mind in so many ways. It's hard to describe, but it was completely magical coming there. And actually, before I went there, I had this feeling that, is this, like, looking at my life, like, is this everything? I was like longing for more spiritual input, and that's something I really got when I came to Sucheca. And yeah, from Trina, I learned how to find mineral pigments in the surrounding area, and also we were experimenting with some plant colors as well. And the range of colors from the minerals was just so, it blew my mind. It was so, and yeah, and the what I also noticed with these pigments that was so different from painting with acrylic colors was how alive the colors felt, like a connection to nature while painting with those colors. It was truly magical. And also the meeting the rainforest was overwhelming. All the sounds and the feeling of being in that forest, just everything felt so alive, so much stronger than I've ever felt in a forest in my own country. It was really, really amazing. And so this was in 2015, and I stayed there for 2 months at Sachaka, and then I continued traveling. It was a 5 month journey in total. So the rest of the journey was in the Pacific, in different islands there. But the basis for the project had been laid in the Amazon. And when I was done with that journey, I felt like such a strong urge to go back to Sachaka and the Amazon rainforest. So in 2017, I came back at a different time of the year. So it was, I think it was in June, July in 2017. And yeah, so probably I will have to go back in the future as well, because it feels like a very, very special place that is now in my heart. But I'm often finding myself longing back to, yeah, everything, the jungle, the pigments, the place where the residency is, and I've been to other parts of the Amazon and also in Brazil. But I've never found a place where I felt that I could move so freely in the area on my own. It felt really safe there. And yeah.
I know you're really humble, Ellen, and you don't like to speak about your granddad, but and we always argue about this, how I feel that that is such a important plays such an important role in your journey to South America and the way that you travel in general. I believe his story is tied into yours. So would you mind speaking a little bit about your grandfather and telling us some of his stories and how that has influenced your art practice and your journey to get where you've got so far?
Yeah, I will. That is actually something that I enjoy talking about, but I think the argument is more on that my grandfather was a person who he was very much against bragging over things, and I think that's also a reason why nowadays not so many people in my country know who my grandfather is if I say the name. But if I say, tell them what things he was involved in, they understand at once. But for me, it has been important to find some personal heroes to inspire, like taking things further, and to like stretch the imagination of what is possible and what one can do. So, using my grandfather as one of my big inspirations, and also I feel that he's also supporting me, that he has been in a way like invisible, but around me as I have been traveling as well. But yeah, we'll talk a little bit about the things he did in his life, because he was in his 20s during the Second World War, and he developed like exceptionally good skills with the sending Morse messages, you know, the di 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 da 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 di di di. And so he was a part of the resistance in Norway, who were trying to fight against the Nazi Germany. And he was sending messages to like the office in England, where England was supporting Norway, and the military office, I don't remember the name, but he was sending messages so they had the complete overview of everything that happened. During the war, my grandfather was learning how to jump in a parachute. And that was in a training camp in Scotland, I think. And there, one day, he met a guy. He was a fellow soldier as well from Norway. And this guy was lying on the ground looking up in the sky. And my grandfather went over and asked, What are you lying here thinking about? And this guy's name was Thor Heyerdahl, and he's a now people know who he is, but at that time that name was not so special. But this guy, he told my grandfather that he was lying and thinking about if it would be possible to cross the Pacific Ocean on a balsa wood raft. Because he needed to convince some, what did he say? Like some bearded guys over in America, that the people living in the islands in the Pacific could have been coming from South America instead of from Asia, which was the what people were sure of at that time. But Tor Heyerdahl, he was exploring the idea that these people could have come from South America. So after the war, my grandfather received a telegram from Tor Heyerdahl, where he said that he was going to cross the Pacific Ocean on a balsa wood raft, and would you like to join as the radio operator on the expedition? And my grandfather said yes. So then he participated in the Kon-Tiki expedition in 1947, and he said that he stepped onto the raft as a broken man after the war. And then, when he walked off the raft and came back to Norway, he was a completely new human. Like starting from fresh, that the whole journey cleansed him from all the pains and all the stress that he had suffered through the war. Right before my grandfather died in 2009, there was a book released that a writer, his name is Svein Sæther, and the book is called Operatøren, which means the operator. He had this writer, he had stayed in the house of my grandparents, and Also using a lot of written material from the war and reports, and also reports and letters from during the Kon-Tiki expedition. And together with interviews and conversations with my grandparents, he had managed to make this book. So that book has been, it was something that I read. I was reading it while I was doing my studies in art. So more and more these stories, and especially the story about the Kon-Tiki expedition, started to bring something up in me, like this. It brought so many feelings of excitement within me, because reading, I remember a sentence from the book where it says that my grandfather says that looking up at the stars in the middle of the Pacific and also seeing this luminescent light in the water in the night was some of the most magic memories from his life. And this just, it hit something inside of me, and I started a painting thinking about these things. And because of this, I also decided to join some friends when they were traveling to South America. They were traveling to the Galapagos Islands, and I decided to join them just because I wanted to see the Pacific Ocean and the stars and the luminescence in the water. And I got to see all that. And after that, I made my first solo exhibition after I started doing my, like, the first solo exhibition I had after starting to study art. And it was called Journeys to the Galapagos and the South Pacific, an exploration through painting. So it was all about memory and color and how the dream of a place looks like versus the memories, and what colors and what textures I brought with me afterwards. So it was a very colorful exhibition. And the ocean, the Pacific Ocean, was what had really stuck with me. So that inspiration from my grandfather was something that made me start explore the idea of doing art as expedition, traveling to another place, meeting people that live close to nature, and learning about their worldviews that has turned out to be closer to the truth, the things that I feel are truths about the world. Those worldviews feel, I realize they feel closer to how I look at the world, more close than what my society tells me is the truth. So it was really, I think, my grandfather who put me on that thought. And I also started getting more and more inspired with the expeditions of Tor Heyerdahl. So while I was studying, I started working at the Kon-Tiki Museum in Oslo in my holidays to be closer to the Kon-Tiki raft and closer to all this adventure. And that's also how I got to know more about the Explorers Club in that has its headquarters in New York. Because one of my like the person in charge in the shop at the museum that I was working in, she was the leader of the Norwegian chapter. So we both shared this love for expeditions and adventure. So that really made like the fire stronger. And yeah. So this was, I think it was like in 2012, this dream started coming. And then in 2015 was when I actually went to the Amazon jungle. Yeah. And then I felt that my grandparents were there with me, helping me, because I had so much luck all the time and I felt so safe. So I felt all the time that they were not far away and that I could ask them for help if I was scared or felt lonely or yeah.
So you talked about Indigenous worldview. Would you say that the Indigenous worldview is different in different countries? And can you just expand on that? What, how that is different from maybe the view in Norway, like and how that has changed your life and how you see the world. I'm quite fascinated in that.
Yes, I will. Yeah, like from my own culture, I was taught, or the message was that a rock is just a rock. Water is just water. It's built up from atoms and molecules, that's it. That flower is just a flower. Yeah, you get the point. And that when you're dead, you're dead. When you're dead, there's nothing more. And when I started traveling, I know that I was pretty naive. But I felt this I felt this truth inside of me that was really painful to carry throughout growing up because everyone around me said things that meant that it was wrong. I remember from when I was very little, I went on walks in the forest where I lived, and I knew where different flowers were growing. So every spring when the snow had melted, I could almost not wait to run to the forest and go look and see if the flowers had come. It was like the same excitement that I felt as when my parents allowed me to have candy. It was extreme joy and happiness and eagerness, and I also remember this feeling when I met the flowers in the forest. I felt very, very touched by them. It's like hard to explain, but I felt emotion, an emotional reaction to the flowers, and I felt care for them, and I felt their beauty and their vulnerability, everything, like a very strong feeling. So in a way, I felt, when I've been thinking about it afterwards, it has been like I felt some kind of connection with the flowers in some way, like a kind of communication in a way. And also,
As I grew up, I, like I said before, I started to spend time in the forest. And what it was about with the forest, I think it was because I didn't feel alone in the forest because there were so many trees. And I felt a support in the forest. Like, yeah, I was being held in a way and safe. But the worldview of my country is like the main view is that, of course, there are religious people as well, but the main common view is that you are, when you're dead, you're dead. And that means that when somebody close to you dies, they are gone forever. And this also means that you are very much alone in this world. Like, yeah, you can feel so extremely alone, and if you don't have a have are lucky to have a family that supports you and is alive, you're or friends, really good, yeah, good friends, you're very much on your own. And when I started traveling, I went to the Amazon, to Easter Island, Tahiti, Samoa, and New Zealand. And later on, I've also visited the indigenous people in Norway, the Sami people in the north of Norway. And something that I realized throughout my journey was that something that was a common thing between the different indigenous people that I met was in the belief that the ancestors, your ancestors, are there to support you. That you are always surrounded by helpers, and that you can ask both ancestors and the force of nature itself to help you when you need, when you are in need of help or need guidance. When, yeah, in Easter Island, the people there have built these giant statues. It's several hundred years ago since they stopped making the statues, but the saying is that they would bury their dead, and they would be buried behind the bones, or buried behind each statue, one person behind each statue. And then the mana, like it's a complex word, but the energy or the force, it could be creative force or luck at fishing or talents of that person used to have, it would then, this mana would then rise up in the statue when they put the last thing they did on the statue was to carve out the holes for the eyes, and then they would put this white coral or shells in this hole, and then the mana of that person would still be with its people. so they would continue to have the luck or the power or the talents within their community. And when I was in New Zealand, I met the woman from this people called the Tuhoi, and she was very, very, very interesting. She was wife of one of the chiefs in the area, she told me, and she had this facial tattoo on her chin. And she told me that it was kind of like a language, that the patterns and shapes would let another Maori person know where she was from, who she was. So it was a way to communicate her identity in a way. And she told me that for them, the ancestors are very much present in their lives, and that they can see the see like do you say like that they can see the ancestors walking behind each person. And she also told me that she could see mine standing behind me, and that it can be different ancestors at different times. It's the ones you need to guide you at the point you are in your life or in the situation you are in. And I really, really like this way of being a part of something much, much bigger. And something that I also really like with the different Indigenous people is the thought of respecting nature. I know that the Tuhoi in New Zealand, I read in a book about that people that before entering the forest, you will ask the forest for permission to enter. And if you kill an animal, you will thank the animal, thank the forest for giving you this food. And I know that I'll say this first, that the Tuhoi, or when I was visiting this place, it was a nature reserve, and this area had been taken by the government long, long time ago. And when I was visiting, they had just gotten the rights back to their land, the people that had originally lived there. And what they decided was that this land is nobody's land, because this land belongs to this land. And I thought that was such a inspiration, because in the Western world, and yeah, almost everywhere, we grab land, we buy land. This is my land, this is your land. And it doesn't, in a way it makes sense, but in another way it does not make sense at all. And yeah, I have a friend that I met in Brazil. She's Brazilian and she's a biologist, and she's working with indigenous peoples in the Brazilian Amazon. And I'm learning so much from her, and she has told me about people that she was visiting that they made their plates and their cups and everything from a clay from an area nearby. And when they went to get this clay, they would ask the clay if they were allowed to take some, and they would explain why they needed the clay, because they would use it to make plates and cups, and if that was okay, and they would get an answer. And when I was at the time I met this friend of mine, I got to spend an evening with her and a social anthropologist that she was working together with, and he had lived with one of these peoples, I think it was for 20 years or more, and learned the language and everything. And he talked about this story about that there was this something that the people in the village was talking about, that every time of the year, I think it was, could be July or something, it would be a period during the year when it got colder in the area. And the people knew that this time would come when they saw this sloth man, the animal, the sloth, but it was a sloth man coming down the river, paddling in his canoe. And then he would have all this mist behind him, so he came with the mist, and that's when the cold period arrived. And like something that we, like the people from the societies in the West, like we would like laugh at this kind of story, because haha, that's not happening. Like it's just fantasy, it's just a metaphor, or an old tale, fantasy tale or something. But what this guy told me was that he had never seen the sloth man, but the people there said that they could see him when he came. And he himself had never seen the sloth man, but he had seen this paddling oar that was the paddling oar of the sloth man. And this paddling oar was completely different than the paddling oars that these people in the village made themselves. It was like a really beautiful paddling oar. And for him, this meant that in a way this story could be more than a story. It's just that our worldview is limiting us from what we are able to see and perceive and experience. And I find this very, very interesting, because what if the people that I'm used to discussing with, like the people in my own country, what if it was limitations in our own minds that made it impossible for us to see other layers of what is happening around us? And that's something that has been so interesting by learning from people from indigenous cultures, and understanding that what they're saying can't be understood from the thinking systems that I knew from before, that I had to completely turn upside down, like everything I had believed in from before to be able to maybe understand a little bit of what they were actually telling me. And one more example of this is in Easter Island, these large statues. They weigh like several, so many tons, and all the statues are have been carved out from one mountain in the middle of the island, and then they have been moved many hundred meters to different sides of the island. And there is like a big discussion around how they were able to move the statues when they only had limited equipment to make that possible. And there has been so many scientists and researchers coming there, and archaeologists and everything, and trying to find ways that these people could have moved the statues. And so they have been trying with the rocks and ropes and wood to make them look like they were walking, because that's what the people in the island has been saying all the time, that the statues were walking, so they were standing up. So all the researchers have been trying to find a way to move the statues in the walking, like standing upside in that position. And they have managed to find methods to do this, but it's really slow work and really hard work. And it could have been that way. But still, the people of the island, they are saying that some people used to have this really strong mana. They were able to use this strong mana to make the statues walk. And thinking about what I said earlier, for me gives so much more meaning to life if I can open myself up to think that it's possible that these statues could have actually been moved using energy. And of course, it's not possible if you don't believe it's possible. Yeah. So to conclude, there are so many super exciting stories that I've heard during my journeys, and these ways of thinking about things and these worldviews has really enriched my life and made myself believe that the experiences that I have had myself with the flowers in the forest as a child, and the feeling of belonging and being supported in the forest, that there is something more to these things, that it's not just like my illusion, or yeah, that there can actually be something more to this. And something that through my painting process that I've thought was very interesting is that everywhere that I have been painting using natural color pigments that I have found in the place, mainly mineral colors. And then I have been painting with kind of like the same process that I've been taking in stories and from the culture nearby and cultural expression, their creative expression, seeing tattooing and artwork and handcraft and museums, and then being in nature. And everywhere I've been painting in nature and paint like taking all the impressions in, and then letting it out in this abstract painting. And something that I've found so interesting is that in each place where I've been, even if I'm not planning what I'm going to paint, I'm just starting and then seeing what appears. And it's as much a surprise for myself what comes on the canvas as it would be for if I wasn't the one who made them. And in each place, even if I've followed the same procedure, the paintings, the shapes, the patterns, the expression is different in each place. And I have been curious if there is something in the consciousness in each place that has been making, like that has been inspiring people in different places in the world to make exactly those patterns that they were making. And that is also something that I've been exploring while moving around with my painting project.
So we're coming to the end of the first part of Ellen's story, where she's talked about her grandfather and the importance of the ancestors in our journeys, and how the world vision of Indigenous people is to carry those ancestors with us and to respect what they have brought to our journey. I have to say that I have a similar experience with my father and how I carry his story into mine also, as he was he was brought up in a very poor family, and he made himself from nothing to a very successful businessman. And I always listen to his stories and bring that into mine as well. And I also look to the Indigenous stories to try and make sense of my own also. So in that sense, we have a lot in common, Ellen and I. So in the next chapter, we're going to be talking a lot more about her video work and her paintings. And so if you want to join us in the next chapter, we will be journeying more into the abstract expressionist world and her sensitivities and how this journey relates into her life's work. Okay, see you in the next chapter.